Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has released its annual Goalkeepers Report, an initiative launched in 2017 to track progress on the UN Sustainable Development Goals. In its seventh edition, the 2023 Goalkeepers Report sheds a light on the global maternal and newborn health crisis, which affects mothers across low, middle, and high-income countries. In sub-Saharan Africa, it is estimated that 390 women will die in childbirth for every 100,000 live births by 2030. Maternal mortality rates have increased. In recent years, in America, the U.S. and the U.K. have the highest maternal mortality rates among high-income countries, especially for Black women. For more insight, I spoke in an exclusive interview with Melinda French Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Take a listen. Melinda French Gates, thank you so much for joining us today. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation just released its annual Goalkeepers Report, which tracks progress made toward the Sustainable Development Goals. This year's report focuses on the health of mothers and babies. How was the data gathered and what stood out to you?
Well, we decided to bring this issue forward this year, the importance of maternal mortality and newborns, because the world has made so much progress on under five deaths of children, but yet that first 30 days of life, and in fact, the first day a baby is born, is the most dangerous day for the baby. And we're still losing 800 moms a day to maternal mortality. So we looked at the data from around the world. We have a number of researchers. One of them is Institute for Health Metrics. And we said, this is data that people need to understand so that the world can do something about it.
According to the report, the world has the tools and innovations to prevent maternal and childhood death. Yet these innovations are not reaching everyone. What are some of them?
Well, some of the innovations that we highlight are things like intravenous iron. There's a woman, a doctor in Nigeria, who has come up with a way to do IV iron, which only takes 15 minutes for an infusion. And what we know is that it makes a woman less likely to hemorrhage during childbirth. That's a fantastic innovation that should be scaled up immediately. Azithromycin, which is a very common drug, something a lot of us use even if we get some other infection. It's low cost. It could be given to moms so to prevent sepsis at the birth of a child. We highlight one other thing in the report. We highlight seven interventions, but another one is a very simple drape, a surgical drape that put under the mom right after childbirth, that it's called Emotive, that can literally measure how much blood a mom is putting out or hemorrhaging from, to know whether the doctor, the obstetrician, needs to intervene right then. So we look at these key interventions that can bring down the most death in women, and we make sure that all of them are ones that can easily be used in low and middle income settings.
And what can countries do to ensure that women in the most remote places have access to the care they need and to new innovations?
Well, several things that countries can do. One is they can make sure that there are enough midwives in the country that are well-trained. They can look at their regulations to make sure that these innovations as they come out, this one that's coming out from Nigeria on intravenous iron, that it doesn't necessarily have to be a doctor that gives it, that it can be a nurse or a midwife who can give it. So changing the regulation of who along the chain can actually do the intervention, that's another important thing that can be done. Making sure that women not only know they need to get to the healthcare facility before they enter labor, but making sure the community knows and makes a plan for that. I've seen that done in Malawi, and it's made a huge difference that women get to the healthcare center early. They can learn about other things that can help their children and their babies, but then they're not caught in a rainstorm where there's no motorcycle available to take them. That's when they get in trouble in terms of the delivery.
Women that do not have access to a health center and perhaps are not literate understand the need for prenatal care?
Well, giving birth to a child is one of the most ancient things we do as human beings. And mothers know that that's a very dangerous day in their lives, no matter where they live in the world. And if you have a good healthcare worker, she doesn't have to be a doctor, she doesn't have to be a nurse, but she goes out into that community and gives the latest messages, women will take those messages up very readily. And in fact, I've met women all over the world, some in Niger even just a few years ago, and I said to them, how do you know when there's a new birth practice or a new, you know, contraceptive available? And they looked at me like I didn't know anything. And they said, well, we talk to each other. We talk at the birth of children. We talk when we go to the well. We talk when we're preparing for something or as we're grinding the millet. We share these best practices with one another. So women have their own social fabric and social messages, social networking that they get the messages out and they take them up readily when they know it will save their life or save their baby's life.
Okay, so the mothers can understand that with the help of community workers and others. Looking at the state of the world currently, we see that the world is confronted with many urgencies such as climate change, COVID, conflicts. How should maternal health and infant mortality remain a priority on the agenda for world leaders?
Well, this is exactly why we're putting the Goalkeepers Report out, is to remind world leaders this is incredibly important. You can't have, you know, these other conflicts or these other issues taking away from this issue. You know, if we invest in moms and babies, moms are the fabric of society. They are the person in the household who decides who eats and in what order and what's fed to the children. They are the ones when the children are sick that take them to the health clinic. And if a baby grows up healthy, he or she are then able to go to school. And guess what? They then get a good job in the informal or the formal sector and they contribute to the economy. So a mom is not only the center of the family, she's the center of the community and ultimately the center of the economy. And so prime ministers and presidents realizing that investing in moms and babies is a good investment for their country overall is something we need to keep highlighting for the world.
You are very passionate about maternal health and childhood survival. The Gates Foundation has been doing this work for many years. For you, Melinda French Gates, what makes you wake up every day and still work to address these issues?
Well, I'm a new grandmother. So I have a 6-month baby granddaughter. I was there with my daughter and her husband at the birth of that grandchild. And look, I've given birth to 3 children myself. I know how scary that day is. And I've been in many labor and delivery wards around the world. And I just know that I want the world to be a better place for my granddaughter. And I see that we've made huge progress in under 5 deaths of children in the world. So I know progress is possible, but I don't want to leave behind a world where this many moms and babies are dying. And I want to make sure the girls have amazing opportunities in the world. Girls have so much to contribute. I don't care where you live. And I want to make sure that we make that easier as a world for my granddaughter and hopefully my other future grandchildren.
Now, coming back to the SDGs, we are less than 10 years to 2030. How optimistic are you about 2030 when it comes to achieving goal number 3 on health, particularly regarding maternal health and infant mortality?
Well, I think, you know, let's be honest, the pandemic set us back. We've seen maternal mortality rise in places. We've seen under-child deaths not being addressed because the health systems are fragile. They were already fragile, but then you put the pandemic on top. But what we're showing this year in the Goalkeepers Report is we actually know how to save 2 million lives between now and 2030. So the 7 interventions that we talk about in this report, azithromycin, IV iron, a simple way of measuring hemorrhaging, a new ultrasound, a tiny little one that's coming out, these interventions can help save 2 million lives between now and 2030. So we want people to know, just like bringing down under 5 childhood deaths, I go like this because it was a graph of all those deaths coming down, it is possible to save these lives between now and 2030. And I think that progress will give the world more momentum to know we can save children's lives and we need forward progress on this.
Finally, this is the 7th Goalkeepers Report. What is your assessment? Where have you seen the most progress and where do you think a lot more needs to be done?
Well, we saw amazing progress on reduction in poverty. We saw amazing progress on reduction in under five deaths, age five deaths for children. Now, the pandemic set us back, and we have to be honest about that. It wasn't something anybody in the world was expecting, but we're starting to see people, you know, are definitely going back to the health system. We're seeing the health systems revitalized. So progress is possible. I worry the most, quite frankly, about gender equality. I see all over the world that places have made excuses and set gender equality back instead of the forward momentum. And that's the one that worries me the most.
So what is your message or the main takeaway regarding the Goalkeepers Report 2023?
800 women should not die a day in childbirth. We can address this. We know how to address it. And we don't need so many babies to die in their first day of life. We as a world know how to save these lives. And guess what? Every life is important and it's worth saving. And progress is totally and completely possible.
Melinda French Gates, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for your time, Lenord.
That was Melinda French Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message, leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
Welcome back to Health Chat. A 2023 study found that in 2021, almost 2 billion people worldwide were affected by anemia, a condition in which red blood cell concentration is lower than usual. It also found that anemia was especially prevalent in Western and Central Africa. From Nairobi, Kenya, Mohamed Yusuf reports on the scope of the problem in Africa and the ways it can be reversed.
Miriam Keita and Sylvia Anyango have anemia, a condition that affects one in four people worldwide. According to the World Health Organization, women are considered anemic when their red blood cell concentration falls below 12 grams per deciliter and men below 13 grams per deciliter. Keita and Anyango partly blame their anemia on pregnancy.
I think I got anemia because I got pregnant again soon after giving birth, and I cannot afford healthy foods.
I cannot
get my blood levels to the required minimum because I would need vegetables to have enough blood in my body. And also, when I give birth, I would be at a disadvantage.
According to health experts, anemia during pregnancy is linked to increased rates of preterm labor, postpartum hemorrhage, low birth weight, stillbirth, and infections in both child and mother. Symptoms of anemia include shortness of breath, dizziness, and fatigue. Doctors say a key cause of anemia is a lack of food containing iron, a mineral the body needs for growth and development. Key sources of iron include red meat, poultry, fish, and eggs.
The increase in iron deficiency anemia, and the most significant contributing factor is household food insecurity. So many of our patients are unable to afford iron-rich foods or basically food at all. They always end up skipping meals to survive or reducing the quantity of food to be consumed or the quality of food.
A 2023 study by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation found that the primary cause of anemia in 2021 was insufficient dietary iron intake. Iron deficiency accounted for 2/3 of all cases of anemia, affecting 825 million women and 444 million men worldwide. According to the study, sub-Saharan Africa bore the greatest burden of anemia, and countries like Mali, Togo and Zambia had a more than 50% prevalence. Besides lack of iron, causes of anemia in the region include malaria, HIV and blood disorders. Josephat Njoroge lectures in midwifery and nursing at Kenya's Amref International University. He says anemia can be treated with better nutrition.
So once this is detected, we start by introducing iron-rich foods to this person. We can also introduce iron supplements. This has been the mainstay of which the government is also putting much emphasis on this. If this anemia is extreme or severe, we can do blood transfusion, where we now have to supplement whatever the blood volume that the patient already has.
The World Health Organization aims to reduce the prevalence of anemia among women of reproductive age to at least 50% of 2012 levels by year 2030. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Now let's go to the United Kingdom, where the first womb transplant offers hope for prospective mothers in their desire to bear children. Take a listen.
A 34-year-old British woman became the first in the country to receive a womb transplant, a procedure that offers hope for prospective recipients in their journey to bear children.
She was absolutely over the moon. There were a lot of tears, a lot of emotion. She was very, very happy. And the donor probably was even happier because she had some time to recover from the anesthesia. So it was a very joyous moment for everybody.
The unnamed woman underwent a transplant in Oxford's Churchill Hospital in February, receiving the organ from her 40-year-old sister.
So she's doing really, really well. She has started having menstrual periods, and that means her prospects of having a baby are very high. She needs to stay on immunosuppressive therapy and to be closely monitored, and we hope to be doing an embryo transfer in the autumn.
The world's first uterus transplant took place in Saudi Arabia in April 2000, performed on a 26-year-old woman.
Some young health medical professionals from South Sudan's Western Equatorial State who completed their studies training in Juba recently have returned to the state capital, Yeongju, to share their knowledge with fellow youth there. The three who are friends are studied together in Juba have started to Gubdue Health Science Institute in order to train more medical workers and give back to the community. State officials welcome the initiative and are pledging to support the youth. Juliana Siaipai reports from Yeongju.
The three young medical professionals who are yet to graduate from College of Physicians and Surgeons of Juba Teaching Hospital have established the Gudu Health Science Institute early this year. Mark Kumbonyeki, the co-founder and the principal of the institute, says while at the college, he and his two friends found one dream.
I and my team decided after completing the HPE program in Juba and waiting to graduate soon, we decided to at least have this initiative to bring the message and the knowledge we acquired from our colleagues and the seniors, the professors in Juba, to bring it down to the community so that our community benefit from the training that we went for. Because before we went, we have a gap. We were having challenges of tutorship and tutors to teach medical students. And we devote ourselves to go and attend the training for 1 year and a half. And we have to come back and deliver the service to our entire community.
Kumbonyeki says he and his colleagues hope the institute will one day grow and attract students from all over South Sudan. He says they started the institute with limited resources, adding that students had to bring chairs from home to attend lectures. Kennedy Ganiko Beime, the deputy governor of Western Equatorial State, visited the institute for the first time on Monday and he pledged to support it.
We want to start by giving you land. So tomorrow, I need official communication from the institute then it will show you where the land is. Also, we will support you to get the registration. Already have talked to my colleague, the Minister of Health, National Government, and also my colleague, the Secretary of the National Government, and those of my colleague in the Minister of Health. They have declared their support to support you and register this initiative as soon as possible.
Ross Obede, Director General of Western Equatorial States Ministry of Health, says the three young medical professionals are committed to deliver rare services to the community in the state capital, Yambio.
We in the State Ministry of Health and all of our facilities, we are lacking. We are lacking cadres like this one to come and take over and help our people. Our mothers are still dying. Our children are still dying. I know now we have hope through this institute to have more capable, understandable, and from the environment to help our people. Because if you bring someone from nowhere, they will not be suitable to this environment.
Malesh Mark Omal, a student leader who is pursuing clinical studies at Goodwill Health Science Institute, says the school has only 40 medical books for 87 students studying at the institute.
We are facing a lot of challenges. One is the library. The school or the institute has no library, whereby to have enough books and the computers for our research and coursework. Then two is at the laboratory. That is for the practical part of it. That is the models and coach, as we are trying to do some physical examination.
The World Health Organization says in 2001, 789 women died for every 100,000 live births in South Sudan. Jackson Marangba Nicholas, pursuing diploma in midwifery at the institute to help save lives of mothers and their babies. He says there are few tutors at the institute.
Another issue also is resources. Under resources, what I mean here is both human resource and materials. Human resource here I meant is the teachers or the tutors. So we don't have all these funds that can bring in more tutors who can take us in all these course needs that we're having. So it is a little bit challenging to maintain the issue of human resources at our capacity here.
23-year-old Joyce Yesto Elisama is studying nursing at the Goodwill Health Sciences Institute. She says she struggles to raise money to pay her tuition fee.
My major challenge is about the tuition fee. I'm not having a work to do so that to be, or anything to be doing so that to be getting the tuition fee. It is so difficult for me to continue, but with this one, I'm appealing to the anyone who can wish like to help me in my education.
The institute offers 3 years diploma courses in midwifery, nursing, and clinical studies. The young medical professionals named their institute Goodwill Health Science Institute after seeking permission from the Azande Kingdom in Yambio to name the institute after the King Goodwill Bajingbi, the first Azande king who was killed by the British in 1905. For VOA News, I am Juliana Shapai in Yambio, Western Equatorial State.
Every 30 seconds, someone in the world has a limb amputated because of a diabetic wound. University researchers in California are developing a smart bandage that they hope will change that grim statistic.
Researchers at the California Institute of Technology are developing smart bandages for chronic wounds, says medical engineer Ehsan Sherzai Sani.
Different types of sensors that we implemented in this patch can monitor the different wound status during the healing process. And over time, we can see what's going on in the wound area and try to give those information to healthcare professionals to make the right decision.
Sensors in the patch monitor levels of uric acid, glucose, ammonia, and lactate, as well as the pH and temperature of the wound for any sign of inflammation or bacterial infection. The bandage can also apply a low electrical field to stimulate the healing process, which researchers say has proven effective in testing on mice and rats. Human tests for smart bandages will be done through the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. USC surgery professor David Armstrong says the technology's implications for amputations due to diabetic wounds is substantial.
And we're dedicated to try to eliminating a preventable amputation over the next generation. And, you know, it starts with trying to prevent these wounds from occurring. And if they do occur, to try to make them as uncommon and as uncomplicated as possible. And what's really exciting is that these tools that we have now, these intelligent sensors.
Armstrong says the concept of smart bandages has become more practical due to smaller batteries and promising research into powering the patches with solar energy or the movement of the patient. Jenny Adulo for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Contracts between big pharmaceutical companies and the South African government show it paid significantly more for COVID vaccines during the pandemic than many Western nations. The non-profit organization Health Justice Initiative recently won a court case that compelled the government to publicly release the contracts. Darren Taylor reports.
Health Justice Initiative, or HJI, Director Fatima Hassan told VOA, pharmaceutical multinationals pressured South Africa into signing what she calls abusive agreements for vaccines. Contracts show Johnson & Johnson Services, or J&J, charged South Africa 15% more for each dose of its COVID vaccine than it charged the European Union. At a time when South Africa had one of the highest infection rates in the world, says Hassan, Pfizer Incorporated charged South Africa 33% more than it charged the African Union. Another HJI spokesperson, Dr. Marlies Richter, says Big Pharma exploited South Africa's urgent need for vaccines.
We all think back to those dreadful lockdown days and the anxiety about COVID and how absolutely desperate we were for vaccines. And I think that desperation created a power imbalance in terms of the negotiations that happened between governments and pharmaceutical companies.
The contracts revealed J&J charged South Africa $10 a dose, while others were paying $7.50. In a statement, J&J insisted it supplied its vaccine to South Africa at the final global price of $7.50. Pfizer also charged $10 a dose, while other nations paid less than $7. Contracts show the Serum Institute of India charged South Africa more than double for a generic version of the AstraZeneca vaccine than it charged Britain. The two companies haven't responded to requests for comment. South African Health Department representative Foster Mohale told VOA the government wasn't bullied by the pharmaceutical firms, but was caught in a situation in which it had to make illogical decisions to save lives. HJI says it thinks it's likely other African nations also paid more for vaccines than did developed economies. Law professor at Wits University in Johannesburg, Jackie Dugard, says she's not surprised by the contracts.
We are in the global south, suffering the consequences of an unequal world in which, of course, the global north is trying to satisfy the interests of pharmaceutical companies and profits and seemingly putting these above the lives of people in the global south. So it's very disappointing.
Richter says the excuse from pharmaceutical firms that vaccines were cheaper in the West because that's where they were made is not valid.
Those arguments often ignore the contribution that the global south has made to the development of vaccines. Many thousands of research participants were included in clinical trials, many here in South Africa, who contributed to the science and the knowledge through public institutions like universities, also using taxpayer money for the infrastructures.
The HJI says South Africa paid more than $730 million for vaccines.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. I'm your host, Linoh Mudu in Washington, with producer Kwame Ofori. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.